Hi, I'm Roy Spencer of PermaSeal. For over 45 years, we've helped over 500,000 homeowners make their homes drier, healthier, and more valuable. Our warranties are transferable and estimates are free. Call 800-421-SEAL or visit permaseal.net.
Tuesday is National Cinema Day. I know you knew that. And we have a couple of segments here that are special, talking about legal movies and about how people perceive the legal system. And with us to talk about this topic is Stanley Fish. He's a renowned law professor and writer. He's taught at top universities like UC Berkeley, Johns Hopkins, and Duke. He is the author of Law at the Movies, Turning Legal Doctrine into Art. Welcome to the show, Stanley. How are you today?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing well. So tell me, you know, you're a lawyer and, you know, you write and you're an intellect and you had decided to write about law at the movies. What sparked your interest in this topic?
First of all, I'm not a lawyer.
Oh, you aren't?
I don't have a degree.
Then you are impersonating one.
I have been a professor of law since the late 70s.
Okay. So you teach law undergrad.
No, I teach in law schools.
Okay.
Don't ask me how that happened.
That's very unusual. I don't know that I've ever heard of a law professor who's not a lawyer. But
it's a good stroke of fortune that I gratefully accept.
Okay. All right. Well, let's get back to the topic of what made you interested in movies?
Well, actually, I was teaching law. And I was watching movies because I watch movies all the time. And then one day I got the idea, why not put these two together and teach a course? Because everything I write comes out of courses that I'm putting together and trying to teach. So that's how it happened. Nothing very dramatic, just an extension of my professional life.
Yeah, you know, there was a great series, and I forgot what it was called. It was not About Last Night, but it was, you know, it was something like that. And it was a series, and it had all the different issues. It had, you know, evidentiary issues. It had ethical issues for judges and for lawyers. And I just thought, what a great opportunity to teach a class where you would have them watch the series and then, like, comment about whether this is realistic or whether it's just, you know, theater. But I think that's a great way to teach students about the system. What do you think? And I think we all know that the justice system presents a very dramatic stage for a movie. What is it that you think really attracts filmmakers to our justice system?
Well, I could answer that question by referencing another movie genre very popular, the Western. Now, in the Western, you might be watching a duel of some kind between Clint Eastwood and John Wayne and somebody. And you would certainly get involved in the contest. But if you're watching a law movie of the kind that I write about, you're not simply involved from a distance as an observer. You're a participant. Because as these movies are constructed, you are made into the 13th juror. And at every instant, as the watcher of the movie, are also making judgments about the piece of evidence that has just been introduced, and perhaps making judgments also on the performance of the lawyers. You can't make a judgment on the performance of John Wayne, but you can make a judgment on the performance of someone who's playing a lawyer in a movie.
And, you know, you talk about some of the older movies in your book, 12 Angry Men, Inherit the Wind, A Man for All Seasons. And in your book, you sort of comment on what the various scenes mean and what the different characters and the different crimes, involve. Like, what is your goal in writing a book like this? What are you trying to do and what are you trying to convey to the reader?
That drama can be made out of what might seem to be the kind of empty or arid soil of legal doctrine, things like mail fraud or third-party beneficiary or class-action suits, all of which sound technical and boring. But the movies that I'm interested in take those issues and make them the heart of a drama, so the drama comes out of the exploration of a piece of legal doctrine rather than rushing past that doctrine to some other theme. And those are the movies that I really enjoy.
And, you know, you take two movies that I'm just coming to my mind, Civil Action with John Travolta mm-hmm. and Aaron Brockovich yes. with Julia Roberts. You know, you have those two movies that have to do with water and the idea that our water might be polluted enough to cause harm to people and communities. And I think those movies, to me, even as a lawyer, really put that in the in the spotlight. And I think that most people, maybe what they know about this kind of stuff comes from those movies. What do you think about the public getting information and education based upon movies like this?
I think that the public can be enormously influenced. I'll give you a piece of evidence of that. You remember Schindler's List, Steven
yes.
Spielberg's great movie. Well, the Holocaust denial industry, and it's a very large one, was absolutely in a fit of anger about that movie. Why? Because they saw how popular it was, how many people would view it, and they felt that if this was the image that viewers carried away, then their arguments, the arguments of Holocaust denial, would suffer.
Interesting. And, you know, what do you see? And, you know, I have these conversations, of course, with my colleagues. Some colleagues really like to watch legal movies, and some say I can't get away from it fast enough. I'd rather turn on anything except a legal movie. But, you know, we do see some liberties taken with the, the true process. What are the liberties that you think are fair to take into, you know, that movie makers implement? And what are the ones that you don't like to see just because you think it's a skewed view of the legal world?
Well, before I answer that question, let me say that I'm not exactly enamored of those people who watch legal movies in order to detect mistakes.
Yes.
It's like people who watch a movie and know that a car went across a bridge in the wrong way, according to the local jurisdiction that they happen to know about. What we have here are people trying to put together scenes in a dramatic fashion, which also make a coherent and sustained statement. So there may be a few mistakes or a few exaggerations. However, in older movies, let's say a movie called Fury, starring Spencer Tracy, directed by Fritz Lang in 1935, if you look at the courtroom scenes, they include things that would never be allowed. Addresses to the jury, addresses to the members of the audience, to those who are in the courtroom. And in Fury, the person who is at the center of the case and is presumed dead walks into the courtroom alive. That kind of thing is no longer, I think, representative of what goes on in legal movies, and it's largely the product not of legal movies but of legal television, and especially of Law and Order.
And
the people who have watched endless reruns of Law and Order, as I do almost every day, become very familiar with a certain set of legal terms, and they watch lawyers who are making very small but important points about what is and is not allowed by the rules.
I think that's one of the biggest liberties that you do see that, you know, and I'll regularly be watching something with my husband and he'll say, hey, that wouldn't be admissible. That's hearsay. I'm like, who died and left you a lawyer? But, you know, you do have to have some liberty with this. And you see this with all movies. You know, you're not going to solve a crime in a 2-hour period. And yet a lot of movies do just that. When we come back, I want to talk some more about this topic. I want to talk about cameras in the courtroom in real cases and how that might have changed the way movies are being made. We are talking to Stanley Fish. He is the author of a new book, Law at the Movies, Turning Legal Doctrine into Art. You're listening to WGN.
I swear to tell the truth, the old truth, and nothing but the truth. So anyway,
I want the truth. You can't handle the truth.
And the truth shall set you free.
I know this isn't easy for you.
What were these other photographs of, Mr. Burke?
Is that a question?
Did you say Utes?
Yeah, two Utes.
What is a Ute?
I am instructing my client not to answer that question on the grounds of self-incrimination.
The prosecution
is not going to get that man today. No. Because I'm going to get him.
I object, Your Honor. This trial is a travesty. It's a travesty of a mockery, of a sham, of a mockery, of a travesty, of two mockeries, of a sham.
I move we dismiss claim for damages on the grounds that those women were not here.
Shut up. I don't want these two fellas pitching knuckleballs at me at the same time.
I object, Your Honor.
Sit down.
Your Honor, I object.
You would.
Bastard.
Hank!
Move to strike that from the record, Your Honor. It's speculation.
Welcome back. We could go on and on that one. I just love it.
That was great.
That was a nice compilation. Hey, you know, I'm gonna throw this out to my listeners, and I'm not sure I'm gonna put you on the phone, but you maybe wanna tell my producer or text me at 312-981-7200 and tell me what legal movie you like and what maybe the movie that you learned about some area of the law that you didn't know about. Right? 312-981-7200. And I'm going to say, Stanley, that I learned a lot about divorce law when I watched Kramer versus Kramer. And I think this was even before I finished law school. Maybe it was right around the time that I was in law school or just graduated. But you know, I never even thought about that as a career path. It turns out that's where I ended up. But I still remember the drama of a custody battle from, you know, the Meryl Streep, the fabulous acting that went on in that movie. That was just amazing.
I would say, I would say the same for Anatomy of a Murder.
Yeah.
Which is really a nitty gritty legal craft movie in which you learn a great deal about the rules of insanity. The extent to which there can be an insanity defense and what kind of insanity defenses will work and what states will allow them and what other states will not. This is all very, very presented in a great deal of detail in that movie in a way that is entirely dramatic and not at all dull.
And did you cover To Kill a Mockingbird in your book?
No, that's not a movie that interests me. Not that I think it's anything but a fine movie. It's not a real legal movie. It's a movie about racial prejudice and about the heroism of one man, in this case Atticus Finch, played by Gregory Peck. Much of it takes place in a courtroom, but the of interest is more in issues of racial equality and personal integrity. It's not a law-focused movie.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. And it's interesting because so many of my colleagues will tell you that they were really influenced by that book, having read it in grade school or high school, because of that character of Atticus Finch, who was, you know, you look up to him as a beacon of justice, you know, to some extent. But let's talk about a little bit about the reality now. Now, of course, reality shows have taken over the world. But, you know, when O.J. Simpson was being tried, that was really, you know, really the beginning of cameras in the courtroom. How Right. do you think O.J. Simpson and that whole long trial that people were riveted to their screens, how do you think that influenced how people viewed the legal system?
I think it allowed people to see that the legal system was something that they could enter, at least from a spectator point of view, and it wasn't mysterious. And, of course, the people who want cameras in the courtroom want to take the mystery out of the law. And one of the reasons I believe that Supreme Court justices don't want cameras in their courtroom is because they want to retain the mystery, the awe of the Supreme Court. But I think that the horse is out of the barn on that one, and even more than the O.J. Simpson trial, the trial of Derek Chauvin, convicted of murdering George Floyd, that was a trial which was on TV, and not only was it on TV, but many of the networks and some of the special networks had panels of legal experts who, after an intermission or a lunchtime period, would come on and review everything that had been done, and two or three people would give analyses. Some of the analyses were conflicting, of course, but the result, I believe, was that the entire audience of Americans felt that this was a drama that they should rightly be a part of.
And, you know, I have changed my mind about cameras in the courtroom. At first, I thought maybe it would disrupt justice, and the most important thing is for the defendant to get justice and for the victim and the state to get justice. But, you know, I just think back to the days of the founders where, you know, public courtrooms are public. A lot of people call me up and say, oh, I want to go watch my friend in court, and but I don't know how to get in. I'm like, well, it's a public courtroom. You have every right to walk in that courtroom, and if a judge tells you you can't, it's got to be because something is being done under seal. But normally speaking, you cannot be prohibited from a courtroom. And so the idea that you can't just walk down to the average courtroom these days, especially in a high profile case. So maybe the only way that courtrooms can be public would be to open the doors via cameras in the courtroom. So, and I agree with you on the Supreme Court, even just hearing their arguments is not enough. You can go on now and, you know, listen to their arguments, but you certainly don't see the dynamics and the personal movements of the litigants and the justices. But I think you're right. I think we're heading in that direction of full cameras in the courtroom.
I think the point was nicely made by Kamala Harris last week when she pointed out that when she was a prosecutor, it was Kamala Harris for the people. That is, this is the arena in relation to which courts proceed, the arena of the people, of the population, of the citizens of the United States.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the more important the case, the more high profile the case, the more important is it to see it. And even so,
because if you don't, if it's not if it's not recorded and by camera, then the space is open for endless speculations. And in the days today of the Internet, you know where endless speculation goes.
Right. You're going to have two different views on what actually happened instead of people just watching it and judging for themselves. And even that, though, Stanley, I will tell you that I commented on the O.J. Simpson case for months, watching it on television. To some extent, I had a day job. But you still don't know what's going to happen, what the jury's going to do, unless you're sitting in that courtroom. So even cameras in the courtroom doesn't give you the whole vibe. And the people who sat in that courtroom told me, I know he's going to be acquitted. I'm watching the jury. I'm watching what's going on here. And there's no way they're going to convict him. And I kept saying, how could they not convict him? But, you know, it's just the way it is. Favorite attorney, To Kill a Mockingbird. Favorite legal movie, 12 Angry Men. A wonderful movie. 312-981-7200. As a columnist for the New York Times, tell me, like, is there a direct influence on these legal movies on legislation, public views? Can you give an example or examples of how maybe a movie has changed the way people think and maybe changed legislation?
Well, I think you began to give examples earlier when you talked about Aaron Brockovich and a civil action. And there's a whole bunch of other movies which deal with environmental crimes by large corporations against small individuals living in small towns. And I think North Country, one of the movies that I talk about, which is about sexual harassment in the workplace in a large mine. I think those movies do heighten the awareness, public awareness, of wrongs that they may not have been aware of, and possibly in a subliminal way exert pressure on the legislative process.
And what I would say, what do you think the future is of law in the cinema? Do you think we're going to continue to see a lot of movies having to do with legal dramas, or do you think people are going to just get enough of it?
I think right now there's perhaps a moment in which the public has had enough of it. But that may be premature. I don't know how many times in the past decades I've heard the death of the Western movie. There'll never be another one. And then there's a revival, and a new kind of Western movie was introduced. Perhaps the same thing will happen to legal movies. Just right now, something new is needed, and it has not yet appeared.
Stanley, I'm going to just ask you to tell me what your top three legal movies are, and then I'm going to ask you to tell our listeners where they can find your book.
Okay. My top three movies are Anatomy of a Murder, which is wonderful because it's localized and tells you how lawyers actually think. The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, John Ford Weston, which addresses the central question that Americans are always worried about, the relationship between American westward movement and openness and the closed nature of the law and its rules. And finally, Judgment at Nuremberg, which asks even larger questions about the relationship between what we might call universal morality and local laws, which should prevail at moments of conflict. So those are my top three.
Stanley Fish, thank you for joining me. Law at the Movies, Turning Legal Doctrine into Art. Where can my listeners find your book?
It's an Oxford University Press book, so it's available in Amazon and all of the other usual outlets. And I'm available for conversations with anyone. But this one has been particularly pleasurable. Thank you.